the collapse of communism, the spread of corporate globalization. These events have been profound benchmarks in capitalism's existence. To many, they have confirmed capitalism as an inevitable outcome of human nature and inherent in the human condition. The idea that we have reached an end of history, or that there is no alternative, rings with the determinism that we are stuck with capitalism. Ellen Makesens Wood argues that a proper understanding of capitalism's beginnings is necessary to end it. Ellen is author of many books, including The Origins of Capitalism, A Longer View. I spoke with Ellen about capitalism's beginnings and its implications. I began by asking Ellen about the assumptions usually made in attempts to explain capitalism. Here is our discussion.
I think the most fundamental common feature is that explanations of capitalism begin by assuming the very thing they're trying to explain. In other words, they're assuming that there are already inherent capitalist principles operating in history or even in human nature, and that all you really need to do to explain the development of capitalism is to explain how the obstacles to that development are removed.
So in your works, you cite 16th century England and agrarian capitalism as its origins. Can you give me a thumbnail sketch of this idea?
Okay. First, I should say that there's quite a bit of debate about whether what was happening in early modern England can really be called capitalism, because you didn't have a majority wage labor force, a proletariat. Wage laborers were still in the minority in 17th century England. The reason I think it's important to call it agrarian capitalism is because you're already seeing a whole new historical dynamic going on at that time. There are already conditions which make it necessary for people to produce competitively, and they're already driven by what I call market imperatives, that is, the need, the necessity to produce competitively, to maximize profit, and to increase labor productivity by technical means. And the reason this happens is that the main economic actors are increasingly dependent on the market for their own survival and self-reproduction. In the first instance, it's landlords and tenants that are relating to each other and to their property in new ways, which force them into this competitive situation. And it's only later on that this dynamic produces, dispossesses more and more people and produces a majority proletariat. But already, long before that happens and as a precondition to it, you're getting this new dynamic operating in English society.
So just to clarify there, some folks look as class struggle as the driving force. What would be the driving force here? The property relations?
Yes, property relations. I don't know that I'd want to set up any sort of contradiction between that and class struggle as the operating principle. I think it's just that most people would want to define capitalism as having to do with wage labor. And I can't disagree with that. I think it's just important to recognize that long before you have a mode of production in which the majority of producers are wage laborers, you already have a new dynamic of market imperatives which is working in that direction, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. You also explore cultural dynamics, the ethic of improvement. What is the ethic of improvement?
Well, the concept of improvement was becoming very big in the 17th century, and it has to do with creating conditions which are both productive and profitable. So that when you talk about improvement of land, you're not just talking about making it more attractive or even not just only making it more productive, you're talking about making it more profitable.
So,
and increasingly you're getting the notion that that is the purpose of production, is the production of profit.
Was this idea of the ethic of improvement in tension with the practice of community use of land?
Yes, of course. I mean, you have to have a complete transformation in the notion of property, and in particular, the extinction primary rights to property. Anything that would interfere with the profitable use of land, its profitable use in terms of exchange value, you know, profit in commercial transactions, would have to be eliminated. And in England, they had a lot of these customary rights. You know, for example, I mean, people might be allowed to collect wood on common land, or they might be allowed at certain times and at certain seasons to pick up the leavings of the harvest. And there were all kinds of ways in which there were overlapping rights to any particular piece of property, and you needed to exclude these sorts of use rights in order to make the most profitable use of land possible.
And now the idea of limiting common use of land or enclosure has been central to these discussions. Marx spoke of enclosure, and Thomas More's Utopia described the process where sheep swallow men. How does enclosure fit into capitalist development?
There were, I mean, in the early period, there were various kinds of enclosure which even, you know, small producers might be participating in and might even be in favor of. But increasingly, it became a way for, you know, larger and more prosperous possessors of land to exclude others. And you get these notions of property, for example, and John Locke is obvious is the most dramatic example. You get these notions of property rights, which are intimately associated with its profitable use. So that, for example, if someone went to court to challenge certain property rights, they could argue that they needed to exclude somebody else's rights to that property for the purpose of improvement, that is, for the purpose of using it in the most profitable way.
So what was the response to these enclosures through peasant struggle, class struggle? What was the resistance to this? Was there resistance?
I mean, there were lots of moments of, there were enclosure riots. It was an issue that kept surfacing throughout the 17th century during the so-called English Revolution and so on. So, you know, I mean, it was a major bone of contention.
So by this point, has agrarian capitalism evolved into a distinct system with its own laws of motion, per se, or is it a precondition for something else?
Well, as I was trying to suggest earlier, you get pretty distinctive laws of motion already operating in the 17th century, and I don't think that you could explain the emergence of a mature capitalism without understanding this first. I mean, you know, capitalism, we may want to talk about a mature capitalism only when it's industrialized, only when the majority is proletarian and so on. But the imperatives of market dependence, the imperatives of competition, accumulation, profit maximization, and increasing labor productivity, this is already set in motion in an earlier period. And you know, a lot of the dispossession that causes this proletariat to develop isn't just a matter of coercive expropriation. It's also a matter of people increasingly falling victim to economic forces, to the competitive forces of the market.
So how did this English agrarian capitalism impact capitalist development in the rest of the world? Was it an alone event, or were there others developing? Or?
Well, of course, this is a matter of great debate. My own view is that its first and most immediate impact on other parts of the world were changes in the nature of imperialism. But I don't think it became able to impose its imperatives on other rivals until it became industrialized. Mm. I think that was the moment at which it really was capable of imposing its own competitive imperatives on its European neighbors and so on. Before that, you know, the English are still involved in the same kind of extra-economic battles and rivalries as their non-capitalist neighbors.
So you've outlined the origins of capitalism in 16th century agrarian capitalism. What does this mean for our own understanding of change of capitalism?
Well, the first thing, I mean, you don't have to assume that is a natural outcome of an inevitable outcome of the laws of nature or human nature or anything like that. It recognized the historical specificity of capitalism. You recognize that it has a very specific dynamic which has operated only in a fraction of human history, and it emerged in very specific conditions. And you have to, I mean, it would be sheer stupidity and arrogance to think that this historically specific social form is going to be eternal, unlike any other that has existed throughout humanity's long history on this planet.